This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Let's Luger, in just a few seconds, you're going to have to deal with me once and for all. And this represents little old Lexi. You make me sick. You get ready for the bell and not be ready for the jack-o'-lantern and all these other things, because in just in a few seconds, I'm bringing that bell out there and I'm going to take that title and I'm going to take it all the way back to Texas.
Boo! All right, everybody, welcome. It is Halloween here on Place to Be Nation. You are listening to PTBN Rewind. My name is Ben Morse. You may have heard me on PTBN's Main Event. You may have heard me elsewhere on the internet, but we don't talk about that. We are celebrating one of our favorite holidays here at the Place to Be Nation. That's Halloween. And for this very special episode, not only are we going to talk about WCW or NWA Halloween Havoc 1990, we are doing, in what we'd call it my day job, a crossover. Crossover episode. PTBN Rewind is crossing over with one of my favorite podcasts, the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. I have with me JT. JT, good evening, sir.
What's up, Benjamin?
How you doing, buddy?
Good. Been a long time.
Way too long. Way too long. It's been days. Full days.
I guess so.
That's yeah. Right. I don't know. Like 2 days ago.
We're in this weird like time warp in the month of October for me. Everything's all over the place. So it's days,
man.
Weeks, months, years. I don't know.
You got a podcast every other day, but appreciate you being on. Of course,
sure.
You do the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, the Place to Be Podcast, Kevin Kelly's show, JT in the morning, whatever else you're doing these days. JT in the Basil. Speaking of Basil, we'll get to him eventually, but I am very excited to welcome all the way from Texas, good old Will. Welcome to PTBN Rewind for the very first time, my friend.
Man, I'm never going to live that down. Never going to live this
make
down
sure of that.
From Texas.
I had my
Might
instructions.
Might as well be a foreign country.
I had my marching orders, man. You know, it's just going that. But seriously, excited to have you on Rewind. I think you're going to bring a lot to the table. No pressure.
Maybe a little bit.
Very nice. Last but not least, stepping away from the producer's chair and into the role of guest panelist, a guy who I've spoken to many times before. Really good dude. The keeper of Basil. Used to do some show with some dude who we don't talk about anymore, but more currently the producer of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. Dan McGinn, my Massachusetts brother. It's good to talk to you, bud.
Ben, likewise, and I hope this goes a lot better than some of my previous podcast experiences. I hope that by the end of this show and months down the road, you and I are still talking to one another, unlike some of the other people I've had and shared the airwaves with in the past.
Well, I'm hoping that by working with you, Dan, I'm going to get offered a lucrative contract elsewhere, so we may have cross purposes.
Dan also has another role. He sits quietly and marks out on the guests of the Kevin Kelly Show, and that's his job, too, on this show.
I forgot about that, yeah. They always say the best producer is one you don't know isn't there.
And I'm, sure.
And I'm certainly not aware of Dan.
He's a hell of a Google Doc updater.
So, boys, we all watch and are going to talk about NWA. I corrected myself earlier because technically in 1990, WCW was just a brand name. It was not the company's name yet. And what I like to do at the beginning of each of these Rewind shows is kind of get a snapshot of each panelist and find out where you were in 1990 as a wrestling fan if you watched this show when it originally aired. Stuff like that. So, JT, let's start with you. I know, like me, you were a WWF guy back in the early 90s. Were you exposed at all to NWA by the time you got to 1990?
No, because I had just become a wrestling fan like around April, maybe a little before. So I was not really quite aware of NWA, WCW, I think until 91, my first like real memory is I think the beginning of the Dangerous Alliance. So probably towards the end of 91 is where I fully became cognizant. I mean, I'm sure on some level I knew because I think I was already getting like PWIs here and there and stuff. So, but I don't really have many memories of watching much of it until later on. So diehard WWF fan at this point, I was all in getting ready for Survivor Series, freaking out as the teams were revealed each and every week. But Halloween Havoc was not on my radar at all.
Conversely, Will, you are a hardcore NWA guy, but I know you've taken breaks now and again. Was this during one of those breaks, or were you all in on the NWA in 1990?
Oh, man, no, I was out, man. I was in the middle of my high school years, and back in 1990, I can attest, I lived it. Wrestling was not cool. And I was, you know, like thousands and thousands of other teenagers just trying to get by without being the complete outcast. In fact, I only knew two wrestling fans in high school. One was a really mean African-American defensive tackle on our football team. And everybody, he'd walk around in like one of those, I want to say not satin, you know, I guess it was satin. I don't know, like a Ultimate Warrior jacket. Like, I don't know what material it was. And nobody told him shit because they knew he'd kill him. And so he was the one wrestling fan, and the other guy was a guy who would like pass out at parties and get pissed on, and you know, definitely didn't want to be that guy. So I was not watching wrestling at this time.
Speaking of really mean linebackers who pass out and get pissed on at parties, Dan, were you watching wrestling in 1990, and were you watching NWA?
Yeah, this was actually like the big first year that I was really into wrestling. Like, it started off, I mentioned this on the last show that we all did, Will and JT, we talking about what our first wrestling memory was, and it was in 1989, and I got my first WWF pay-per-view Survivor Series of that year. But if it was wrestling, I was watching it. Whether it was reruns of World Class on ESPN, whether it was, or AWA, I would try to watch what I could for NWA. And this actually turned out to be the first pay-per-view that I was allowed to get. And actually, it was kind of a surprise. I could go into the whole story. I won't right now, but, this was actually the first pay-per-view that I was allowed to watch that was under the WCW brand, and it was kind of a surprise reward from my dad, and so this is very near and dear to me. Ben,
what did you do to earn this reward?
I think it was probably pity.
oh, it's gonna be one of those nights.
Other
night with JT.
Come on, guys, neutral corners, we're all friends here.
I was raking leaves all day with my dad, as I recall, and we go in, and I was really tired, and I was setting the table for dinner, and for whatever reason, Dad put on the Viewer's Choice channel on the cable box, and I'm like, why are we doing that? That's usually reserved for wrestling shows. And all of a sudden, the pre-show and everything started for Halloween Havoc, and I was like, oh, this is weird. I mean, you only see this if you order the pay-per-view, right? And Dad's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. He played totally dumb, saying that, like, oh, I don't know what's going on. Something must be up with the cable company. Really, and he probably just conspired with my mom, found out there was a show, thought that I'd enjoy it, and turned out I did enjoy it. It was a lot of fun. We'll talk about that.
That is a Charlie Brown pumpkin special-esque touching story, Dan McGinn. Thank you for sharing that. I was actually very similar to you, Dan. I did not see this show, but it was an interesting time for me because I, like JT, like you, I had just started watching around this time. I think the first memory I have is SummerSlam 1990. I don't remember watching it, but I remember watching the setup. And I was pretty much a WWF guy at this point, but I remember vividly flipping over to TBS at some point on a Saturday night, seeing wrestling. It was around the build to this very show because I vividly remember seeing Sting, remember seeing Sid. I remember them getting set up. I remember seeing the Steiners for the first time. I remember seeing Luger. So for years, as I became more of a wrestling fan, Halloween Havoc 1990 almost became this mythical show for me, that this lost memory from childhood, which I was looking to reclaim. And I only watched it in full for the first time a few months ago, as I was kind of chronologically going through the WCW pay-per-views, as I know a lot of people who got the network have been doing. So I just watched this for the first time a few months ago. I rewatched this past week, and it was cool. It was cool to finally get a chance to see it. And it's a very different show. just in terms of the aesthetics right off the bat, and Dan, why don't I bounce back to you, because you know, you watched it when it was originally on. What did you think seeing this like kind of creepy opening video that looked like it was straight out of an 80s B horror movie? You know, the announcers are wearing costumes. They've got the ring set up with red and with the orange ropes and everything. How did that aesthetic stand out to you right off the bat?
Well, for a 9-year-old, it was amazing. It was like, wow, wrestling from a haunted house. Like, the only thing missing was a scary chandelier in the middle of the arena. But really, it was cool. I mean, for 90s graphics and at the time, I mean, you had like the cartoony haunted house. You had like the ghost wiggling faces of the key players in this particular card, the red or red orange canvas with the orange ring ropes. It wasn't all out with like the big haunted house setup, but everything was like really darkly lit. You only could really see the crowd in like the lower bowl. Everything else was like really dark, kind of a far contrast to some of the other pay-per-views that they were putting out for WCW this particular calendar year. Like if you watch something like the Clashes, or if you watch Great American Bash, it looks well lit and patriotic, but this seems a lot more dark, a lot edgier. They really went with the Halloween theme. And as you said, I mean, we have Paulie Dangerously on color. He's dressed up like Dracula. You have Tony Schiavone wearing the cheapest Phantom of the Opera costume imaginable. But they really went with the gimmick, and you got to give him credit for that.
Now, you just mentioned Paul E. I want to shoot over to JT, because JT, you've made no secret on the Place to Be podcast your love for the Paul Heyman and Jim Ross commentary team. Now, that is the commentary team here for Halloween Havoc 1990, but it's about a decade before you praised them. How did you feel they held up at this show, and how were they different from how they would later be in the WWE run?
Yeah, I thought they were really good, and I don't think they were all too different in that they still have like the very antagonistic relationship where Paulie would really prod, JR and take his digs at the various faces on the card. And I thought like it felt like they'd been commentating for like 10 years at this point on this show. Like Paulie, I didn't realize until later on when I kind of caught back up on all these shows that Paulie did so much commentary in WCW. I thought he was strictly a manager, or maybe did like, you know, the B weekend shows here and there. Ross is different, obviously. He's much more still in that sports style of calling the matches, much more faster paced in his commentary. Really kind of whipping through facts and through the play-by-play on the matches. But yeah, I thought their chemistry was immediate, and I like them here just as much as I did years later.
Now, Will, you're an NWA guy. You know, you had shows like Great American Bash, Starrcade. A lot of those were Dusty Rhodes creations. I'm not sure if Halloween Havoc was a Dusty Rhodes concept, but what was different about NWA shows versus WWF shows just when they come up with concepts? Because I always felt like they had they're a little more bold, a little more daring with their concepts. It wasn't just necessarily, you know, this is a big supercard. They would really do cool themes.
No, I agree with you. And I think after the Starrcade debacle, you know, like where Vince basically froze Starrcade out in the late 80s, you know, and pay-per-view was becoming the norm for wrestling pay-per-views. I think they really captured it right. Like, I couldn't tell you, like, I know Hell in the Cell is this month for WWF, but I couldn't tell you before the Hell in the Cell pay-per-views, because I know that used to be in the summer. I have no idea what the October pay-per-view for WWF was before that. You know what I mean? They didn't have a pay-per-view that stuck. Automatically, boom, you knew Fall Brawl was September, Halloween Havoc was October, Great American Bash was in the summer sometime, but you knew Super Brawl was in February. You knew Spring Stampede was in April. You really had a sense that it was a major event on the calendar. I mean, now SummerSlam, Mania, Rumble, those have stuck. You know, I'm not knocking them for those. But at the same time, like, it just fit. Like, and like you said, they're a little bit more daring. I mean, gotta love alliteration, right? Spring Stampede, Halloween Havoc, you know, and we all like that stuff, SummerSlam. But I think that the NWA, because look at Great American Bash. It started off as a tour, you know, and then when pay-per-view became popular, then it became a pay-per-view. But that's a big, bold concept. Let's call an entire tour across the country the Great American Bash and celebrate it, you know, and in 1980s Reagan era, USA, rah-rah, Cold War setting, it was a great concept. And, you know, I don't know if – I think Dusty was with WWF by the time Halloween Havoc came out, right? In 89, he was already stuck there. So it couldn't be a Dusty creation. But either way, they hit the mark. Because
it feels
here
like a
we
Dusty
are.
Creation in spirit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. But here we are, you know, 20-something years later, 26 years later, talking about Halloween Havoc, but yet we're not talking or celebrating the WWF Halloween pay-per-view. Plus, I mean, dude, look at the crowd. This is a pretty good-sized crowd. It's 8,000 people in a down period for the company, okay? But the crowds always seem a little bit grittier, you know, in WCW. They always got up for the big matches, and something we didn't see in WWF, we could see two guys work their asses off in WWF, but unless they were really over or the match was important, the matches didn't get over. Guys in WCW might get a tepid reaction initially, but by the end of the match, they could win the crowd over. And you see that a lot more with WCW, where the wrestling will win a crowd over than it would in a WWF crowd.
I think it's a good point. Well, I think you see that a lot on this show, and let's talk about the wrestling. Let's go to the in-ring action. The opening match, it's interesting because it's almost a classic pairing, because you got the Midnight Express on one side, Bobby Eaton, Stan Lane with Jim Cornette. On the other side, you have Ricky Morton, one half of the Rock and Roll Express, but he is not partnering with Robert Gibson. He is partnering with Tommy Rich. Now, Dan, I know you've done extensive research for this show. Was there any sort of issue between these two teams going in, or was this just a hot opening tag match?
Really just a hot opening tag. And in fact, I want to talk about some of the booking decisions, you know, as we go along. I think they always had in the back of their minds, if worst comes to worst, we can always just throw some form of combination of the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express during this time period. And a lot of the times you would find that the Midnights would basically have the best match regardless of who they were facing. They could be facing Pillman and Zinc. They could be facing this team that was put together kind of on the fly. Robert Gibson was injured. And according to the commentary, he was going to be out like 8 to 12 weeks or something at this point or what have you. And they threw in Wildfire Tommy Rich to get that hot tag that was so famous when Gibson was paired up with Morton. And really, it was funny because, it was a little bit of a difference. But this match is really thought upon very highly regarded. It went over 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Morton took a ridiculous ass kicking, as he always tends to do in these types of matches. And listening to our colleagues, Parv and Chad, this was basically the swan song of Jim Cornette with the company. So, and he really put on his working shoes, really getting involved, interfering, using that racket, distractions. I mean, he knocks Rich from the top turnbuckle with his racket, and he was basically, Rich acted like he was dead. So, I mean, there was like a lot of really good things to pull from this. So on the surface, you're like, oh, why is Tommy Rich in there? Man, this would have been so much better if it was the regular Rock and Rolls versus the Midnights, but it actually turned out to be quite a gem on this card.
Hey, Dan, what about that flying knee drop from the top turnbuckle to the ramp?
Yes, that was awesome.
That was pretty nasty. I just wanted to make sure somebody mentioned that spot. You know,
absolutely, so, especially for 1990.
Yeah, it was an assisted one, too. It wasn't like a rocket launcher into the knee. That was stiff. That was great. I like that spot a lot. I like the commentary, too. They really pushed the psychology of the match well here. I thought this is right out of the gate. They were showing that cohesion and the way they could push the story throughout the match. And I agree with Dan. Cornette was really good. Lots of interference. And another great spot was Eaton. Hit a flawless Alabama Jam in the ring. I mean, just spot on. Nailed it. And Ricky Morton's Hurricanrana on the floor, I thought was good too.
Yeah, it's always interesting in the early 90s trying to hear what they're going to call a Hurricanrana or a Frankensteiner because they don't have a name for it yet. So it's always like a victory roll.
Yes.
Yeah, or just what? To Jim Ross's credit, he would try to come up with something. He would try to explain it the same way he would later call Sid Vicious's powerbomb a modified body slam, which I appreciated. But not only is this the last match for Jim Cornette, this is actually the last match for the Midnight Express on a major show on pay-per-view. They ride off into the sunset after this because Jim Cornette and Stan Lane go off to form Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Now, Will, you're a big Midnight Express fan, right?
Yeah, but with the caveat that I am a bigger fan of Eaton
the
Condry. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think of this as kind of a last stand for the Midnight Express, or because it's not your Midnight Express, do you not count it?
Well, no, I still love this team. It's just like I have Eaton Condrey as like the number two team of all time, but I have right. this team at like top 10 of all time. So,
sure.
You know, people got to remember, I'm actually going to give a little background on some of these guys, like Stan Lane. Stan Lane was a great tag wrestler teaming up in the Fabulous Ones before
Steve
he ever
Kern.
Became Bobby Eaton's. Yeah, exactly. Before he became Bobby Eaton's tag partner. The Fabulous Ones, another like top 10 tag team. Bobby Eaton, we've seen, might be the best tag team wrestler of all time. And I'm just going to get a quick plug. I'm going to do a show with Stephen Graham and those guys where we kind of run down the best tag team wrestlers, you know, where we each like list our top five or top six tag team wrestlers, not tag teams, but the actual wrestlers. And, Bobby Eaton will definitely be in there. Ricky Morton will definitely be in there. But I know Dan kind of said, like, you know, why would we throw Tommy Rich in there? The interesting thing about Tommy Rich, and as a big Memphis fan, I'm already a Tommy Rich guy. You know, you have Paul Heyman guys, I'm a Tommy Rich guy. Nobody bleeds better than Tommy Rich. You know, has that bleach blonde hair, and he's not afraid to let the blood flow if you've ever seen his forehead. Okay. But Tommy Rich could go, and he actually in 1989-90 was kind of experiencing a resurgence as like a worker. Like,
I agree with you. 100%.
He had really good matches with Lex Luger in 89. He had he carried Ron Simmons to a really good match in 1989, which, you know, people, you know, it was just a random episode of NWA TV. Just good match. Had good matches with Eddie Gilbert, you know, who was his former tag partner in the New Fabulous Ones, in a classic Memphis angle that I beg all of you here on the line and anyone at home, just type in Tommy Rich, Eddie Gilbert, Memphis. Find it, watch that angle, and just marvel at the greatness of that. So Tommy Rich is already, to me, in my eyes, a great wrestler. But, you know, these guys, Morton and Rich, I mean, they were born and raised in Memphis wrestling. Not born and raised literally in Memphis, but they were Memphis wrestling bred. They worked the territories, you know. Morton had worked Southwest, worked Memphis, Mid-South, you know, Texas, not Texas, Crockett, whatever. But, you know, Rich, Georgia, Memphis, Alabama. So these guys have been around. You know, they're proven veterans. You could probably put them in a tag team with any other wrestler, and whether it's Rich or Morton, they're going to have a good tag match just because they'd been there, done that. And so I really wanted to just kind of point that out, that all four of these guys are there. Now, back to your question. the Midnight, it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad because this is a match where you look at, like, the Midnight Express. They're in their matching gear. You know, I mean, Stan Lane always wore the trunks. Bobby always wore the tights. But you look immediately and you say, okay, Ricky Morton's the outdated one. Still wearing the fringe. Still has his mullet, you know. Has kind of gotten older, a little bit more wrinkles in the skin, doesn't look like the baby face, fresh meat baby face that he was for all those years that the girls loved him. But it's kind of depressing because even the Midnight Express feel dated. Does that make sense? Like
oh, yeah.
They have great offense, they're great wrestlers, but they feel dated even in 1990. They felt like a relic of the past. And it pains me to say that because I never really picked up on that watching this, because this was a great match. But it just feels like that's kind of been wrestling's curse, right? Is that wrestling was always behind the times and wrestlers are always the last ones to catch up, you know, and or at least their booking offices are. And so, yeah, it was really sad to watch, you know. Cornette's awesome. Lane still pulling out the cool karate kicks and dancing and doing his thing. Bobby Eaton is always a great wrestler, but the act actually felt dated here, man. And it's kind of a weird thing to pick up from such a great match.
Yeah. I mean, I think to your point, Will, is that in the ring, they weren't over the hill. They were performing as well as ever. I think the thing was, you look at, and we'll discuss later in the card, the guys who were on top as far as tag team wrestling in 1990 in the NWA, you had guys like the Steiners, you had guys like Doom, these big muscled up guys. Aside from the Road Warriors, that wasn't really the norm in 1980s NWA. You had the Rock and Rolls, you had the Fantastics, you had quick moving or technically savvy teams. So I don't know. For me, that's why they felt a little outdated.
No, you're right. Arn and Tully.
Yeah.
you know, the both versions of the Midnights, Ravish and Rick Rude and Manny Fernandez, you know, these high impact teams, you know,
and
they're still high impact. I'm just kind of looking at it from like an aesthetic, looking at these guys. It's almost like guys in their 30s trying to act like guys in their 20s.
Yeah.
Just not as cool as guys in their 20s acting like guys in their 20s.
Good line.
Yeah, and to your point, guys, like I remember watching as a kid and seeing and hearing them talk about how, and this could be the fifth opportunity or the fifth time the Rock and Roll Express will win the tag team gold. And I used to, because I was grew up with WWF and watched and saw the teams here, Doom, Steiners. And I'm like, how on earth does a team like the Rock and Roll Express win the tag titles? But it was during a time period where I thought you had to be muscle bound and, you know, roided up in order to win championships.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, the finish of this match comes when the Southern Boys, another great tag team, kind of underrated WCW tag team, come out dressed as Jim Cornette, allowing Rich and Morton to get a distraction. What that segues me to is the fact that the Midnight Express are essentially feuding with the Southern Boys here. More to the point, Tommy Rich and more Ricky Morton, and especially the Rock and Roll Express, are feuding with the Freebirds. They reference it in a pre-match interview. The Freebirds were the ones who took out Robert Gibson. They were the ones who the Rock and Roll Express has an issue with. Yet here on the pay-per-view, these two teams are not facing their rivals. Now, this was something that would happen all the time back in the early 90s. Justin, what did you think about this kind of booking and, you know, not necessarily having, you know, saving the grudge matches for the house shows? Did it throw it off, or are you just like, well, you know, a good match is a good match?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think that's what they really want to do was save it for the house shows, I guess, or at least continue it on TV and push it along. I think we're still in a period where some of these companies weren't always sure how to use pay-per-view. I mean, I think by 90, we're kind of there, but I think it was still fairly new enough. I mean, even if you look at some of the matches, and you know, I'm sure we'll mention this, that we watched the cut-down version on the network. I mean, some of the matches we didn't see are just like throwaways in the middle of the card that are just matches. And that happened a lot of those WCW cards in 90, 91, even to 92, where you'd have more throwaway matches and not every match was like a big feud that had led up to it. So I think that's just what this was to get these guys on the card, open the show hot, and then push the other issue along. You know, I'm fine not having to see the Freebirds, you know, because I like the match that we got here. So I'm fine.
Oh, you'll see the Freebirds.
Oh, I know we do,
friend.
But at least I'd rather this match be left alone then broken apart. I hated the finish, by the way. I don't know. I thought it was a wicked goofy, and I don't know. I know why the Express didn't win because of the transition that was happening, but watching it again is like, God, the match was so good, and then they come in goofing around. I don't know. It kind of didn't really resonate with me.
Well, also, you got to remember, Rich and Morton are just, I don't know, minutes away from becoming the York Foundation, right? So maybe they wanted
now,
to kind
I think
of...
they'd be teaming again as the York Foundation.
Yeah.
Was it a year? I thought it was sooner than that.
Oh, no. I think, well, because Terrence Taylor, or well, first it was Michael Wall Street, then it was Terrence Taylor,
okay.
Then it was Richard Morton, then it was Thomas Rich. So I'd say by about Halloween Havoc 1991, Rich had come into the fold. So
okay, but well, I know Morton was definitely part of it in the summer because he fought Gibson.
He fought Gibson at the Great American Bash.
But either way, maybe they just want to plant the seed early. Right. Maybe they had actually planned in advance. You know, that's shocking for a wrestling company at this time.
Now, who knows?
What really upsets me is if you look at the full match list, and I know we didn't get to watch this excellent encounter on the network version, but the Southern Boys who you referenced, Tracy Smothers, Steve Armstrong, actually fought the Master Blasters, Kevin Nash and Al Green. later on in the show. So, you know, we got it. We had to make sure that the Southern Boys got squashed by the Master Blasters in a 7-minute epic match.
So. Yeah. Unfortunately, we'll not be talking about that. We will not be talking about Brad Armstrong against JT Southern. We'll not be talking about all the great matches we missed.
Was it JT Southern or JW Storm?
JW Storm.
Yeah. Was it JW Storm? I was reading about JT Southern earlier today for some reason.
JW Storm was, I remember him from a couple of prime times in like 91 or 92, and I always thought he had like, I didn't know about him that he was like in WCW here, but I always thought he had a good look, and so I was always surprised they didn't do more with him. Like he,
you know,
had
now
a
that
really
you mentioned him, I think I remember him too.
Yeah.
I think he needed a charisma transplant.
Yeah.
You know, and a new name. I mean, JW Storm was, you know. Might as well call him Lance Storm for as much charisma as he had, you know.
Something that was going on this show and something that did not get cut out of the network version I'm going to turn to Dan McGinn here for a moment because Dan, you did a great job summarizing the first match. Tell us a little bit about this mysterious figure called the Black Scorpion and his place on Halloween Havoc 1990.
I feel like this is something that Glenn needs to be explaining because it
I almost want to call Glenn to get him to do this, but you know, you're going to be the next best thing.
Like Glenn could do a run in. So Sting's being interviewed by the Phantom of the Opera and stumbling over his lines and everything as the new world champ, not a good look, but what are you going to do? And all of a sudden, a very mysterious voice comes over the loudspeaker. That sounds
not that mysterious. It was Ole Anderson.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Thanks for trampling over that line. And Sting looks shocked, as everybody else was. And they kind of do this wide shot of the two different stages, basically the entrance ramp and then this little interview stage that the that Sting's on. And for whatever reason, there's this weird, like, platform, you know, metal grating set up with a curtain on it that's also on the stage that was just sort of left there. And the Black Scorpion grabs a crew member, a female crew member, and goes onto this platform, pulls the curtain, and Sting tries running over to try and save her, but gets stopped by other crew members for whatever reason. And then when he finally breaks free of the crew members, he opens up the curtain. I'm talking like the Black Scorpion's gone. This girl away, but next thing you know, you see him on the platform that you know, Sting was just on. So then Sting goes running back over to that second stage, and Black Scorpion runs away. The girl leaps into the arms of Sting, who saves the day, but really puts a dark cloud over the rest of the evening, guys.
You know what this was like? It was like a Disney stage show where it's like, oh, it's like so overacted. And, like, they're just doing it for the live audience. Or, like, I don't know, have you been to, like, Las Vegas where they do, if you go to the, like, the Pirates of the Caribbean show or whatever, where it's just, like, way overacted and overdramatic. Yep. Like, oh, no, the damsel's in distress. And, like, Sting swashbuckles his way over to the other stage. And, like, it is just so ridiculous that, like, when Sting's, like, desperately trying to run over to save the fan, like, what was this magician going to do? I mean, it wasn't really, like, established as some, like, vicious psychotic heel or anything. Like, he was going to slit her throat. I mean, he's doing like parlor tricks, you know what I mean? It's something you'd see like in a, you know, dinner theater. It was just absurd. It was so stupid. It's like, oh God, this guy's gonna, oh, okay, move her from one side to the other through some kind of weird teleportation. It was just odd. It was just, Scorpion didn't even feel like a threat even here in any way. Like beat Sting down or something. The whole thing was just stupid.
Well, to be fair, you don't really have to be a threat because it's already been established that Sting, dumbest baby face ever.
That is true. And I like Sting, but yeah, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. How far, maybe one of you guys know this better than me, how far into the Black Scorpion angle were they at this point? Had they just introduced the Black Scorpion, or had he already been around for a few months at this point?
They had actually a match at the Clash
Champions, right, yeah.
That was before this. And I'm sure there were other vignettes and other stuff before that, but they had a match, and basically Scorpion said before the match that if Sting beats him, then he'll reveal himself to Sting. And what ends up happening is Sting wins the match, but that Scorpion that he fought slid under the ring, and then on the entranceway stood another Black Scorpion. And I guess that became kind of like the thing. They weren't really sure exactly who the Black Scorpion was supposed to be, so different wrestlers would don the mask and basically mess with Sting leading up until probably Starrcade, I would imagine.
Yeah, that was essentially the deal. We'll talk more about Sting later in the show. We'll talk a little bit more about his booking, because I get some questions I want to ask you guys, particularly in comparison to another champion who wasn't being booked, in some people's opinion, so great around this time. But back to the ring, we've got the Fabulous Freebirds. And for those who are expecting Terry Gordy or Buddy Jack Roberts, nope. This is the new incarnation of the Fabulous Freebirds, the 90s incarnation of Michael P.S. Hayes, familiar face, and Jimmy Jam Garvin. They go up against the Renegade Warriors. And I think their sole pay-per-view appearance.
For the best.
Not quite the match we had in the opener. JT, talk to me about the Renegade Warriors. What did you think of these guys?
I thought they had a terrible look. This neon Indian thing they had going on was like, hey, let's do a, you know, kind of tasteless old school 70s Jay Strongbow knockoff. But you know what? It's the 90s, so let's put neon tights on them. it's like they couldn't decide what they wanted to be. I thought they were actually a little bit smoother than I expected, but I didn't think they were like just based on their look alone. It was just a typical like going nowhere, throw them out there as a gimmick. But these guys really have no long term future if this is what they're going to be. And I also just want to throw out one of my favorite lines ever by a ring announcer: the number one roadie and best friend, Richard Marley
of the Free Press. Oh man, poor best Rocky friend. King.
Best friend.
Rocky King dressed as Robert Gibson is what they keep saying. And
right,
by
yeah,
dressed
right.
as Robert Gibson, Marley, they mean yeah. he has the Rock and Roll Express tights on.
Yeah. Hey. Oh, sorry. I was just going to mention.
No, go ahead.
Earlier, I said that the Midnights felt dated, and oh my God, you know. My man, Michael Hayes, is probably like 30 years old at this time. Like, he's super young, right? Like, he achieved all of his fame when he was in his early 20s, okay? With the Von Erichs Freebirds feud. And talk about a guy who just was outdated, not cool. There was nothing cool about the Freebirds at this time. If that was to be going for, it might kind of have a weird campy vibe to it, but it was clearly two guys who were trying to think they were cool. You know what I mean? Who clearly thought they were cool and just missing the mark. You know, it was so bad because Michael Hayes was so like part of the sign of the times in the early 80s, mm-hmm. but so not part of the 90s. Yeah, it was really depressing.
His gear was just absurd. I mean, just absurd here. I liked the Marley wearing the rock and roll tie. Like, I thought that was a good heel dig. And Ben, maybe going back to our previous question, maybe that's why they were just waiting for Gibson to come back to push that feud along. Like, why have right. Morton in the tag with them when the whole idea was to wait for the rock and rolls to be back together. But I liked that part of it. But yes, Hayes looks, he just looks absurd. Have you guys ever seen Hot Tub Time Machine?
Yeah.
Yep.
Will.
Of course.
Okay. So you know the end where they do the music video at the end when they all come back and they're all successful and Rob Corddry's like all dressed up like that. This is what Michael Hayes looked like. He's got like the eyeliner on and that. And I know that's what the glam rock looked like at the time, but that whenever I saw him, that's the first image that popped in my head was Rob Corddry at the end of that movie when he's all dolled up as what are they singing to? Oh, I can't think of the song they were singing.
Home Sweet Home.
Yes, Home Sweet Home. Thank you. And he had the exact look, and it was just as ridiculous.
Well, if you remember now, 1990, grunge hadn't hit yet, right? Right. So we're not in the grunge era. We're just that whole glam pop metal stuff was completely rejected. But Guns N' Roses, when they came out late 80s, and they had that kind of sleazy vibe. So all of these glam rockers, you got to remember, they started kind of going away from the makeup from like 85 through 87, you know? And they were going more for that. We all ride motorcycles and we're all kind of cool bikers with poofy hair versus bikers who want to be women with poofy hair, you know? And so, you know, even then Michael Hayes failed, you know what I mean? Like, you know, if they would have come out seriously in like biker jackets and ridden Harleys and like videos, it kind of would have been a sign of the times of what like that glam rock vibe was going for. This was not what any popular band in 1990 was going for.
I will say this. I think the Freebirds, or at least Garvin anyway, kind of toned it down a little bit from the previous pay-per-view that they had, because Garvin even had like kind of like the bedazzled, really shiny, had the hair, you know, like really pulled back and had the eyeliner and everything going. And I think this time he's just in regular trunks this time around. But Hayes, I'll give him credit. He just continued to rock on and continued to go through with it and had like... And it was it's funny because it's a real difference. This crowd too is a little bit different because that particular crowd completely rejected the Freebirds. They were they were making all types of derogatory statements and calling Michael Hayes a bitch and that sort of stuff. But this crowd kind of almost was like it's almost the reverse. They were almost rejecting the Warriors and really going into and getting that nostalgia feel with the Freebirds going.
You know, I want to ask a bit of a larger question that goes outside this because we're talking about the Freebirds. There's been a lot of talk about Freebirds going into the Hall of Fame this year, WWE Hall of Fame at WrestleMania. Do you guys, and feel free to just jump in here if you have an opinion, Do you guys feel like people remember the 90s Garvin Hayes Freebirds, and is that kind of a black mark on the Freebird legacy, or is that just kind of a separate entity from the classic world-class run?
I'd say separate. I mean, I remember this entity because it's the first I was introduced to, but I don't even think of them as the same at this point.
Right.
Like when it's the Freebirds like go in. No, no way. I think when the Freebirds go in, I'm hoping. I mean, I'm guessing they'll probably put all four of them in when they do it, but I don't think anyone. It's almost like the two DXs. You know, it's like it's all DX, but you still remember them very separately.
I don't think I don't think that they do put Garvin in with them.
I'm with Will. I don't think
I think
seems like he's on good terms with them. That's why I thought maybe they would.
I could see him going in at some point. I just don't think he goes in as a Freebird.
No, I don't see him ever going in. I mean, I just don't. I don't think he has the meat's not there. You know, I mean, because one, I mean, even the jobbers that get in were jobbers in WWF. You know, your Coco.
That's true.
Waiters.
He never had a WWF run.
Never had a WWF run, and you know, maybe he's on good terms with them. But I mean, how awkward would it be? It's going to be bad enough if Michael Hayes is there by himself because Buddy, Jack, and Terry are dead. But it's going to be even more awkward that they're dead, but he's standing up there with Jimmy Garvin. You know what I mean? It's just going to make it stand out even more that the other two original Freebirds aren't there. I don't think that they put them in. I'm not even sure that Vince even puts the Freebirds in. It makes sense. They should. Austin's clamoring for it. Everyone else is clamoring for it. But, you know, like with the racist allegations against Hayes and stuff, I don't even know if WWF wants that to even be an issue. So I don't even know if he ever gets in.
I think if they go in, it may not have even been planned a few months ago. It's just because they're talking about it now. And now they don't want to address, you know, why didn't we? Because if they address why didn't we, then you have to bring up, you know, what you just talked about, Will, with the other stuff. But that's neither here nor there. We're back in 1990. The Freebirds win this match with the DDT and some shenanigans. It's nothing to write home about. But
1990, when racism in wrestling was completely acceptable.
Yeah, totally
neon
fine.
Racism.
As long as you dress up in some neon, you're fine.
Oh, wait, hold on. Wasn't the Ric Flair Junkyard Dog feud here in 1990?
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Yeah,
it was.
There's definitely some racism rolling in 1990, that's for sure.
Speaking of Ric Flair, he does a quick interview with him, Arn Anderson, and Sid Vicious, three of the four horsemen. What did you guys think of this horseman lineup? Because I'll be honest, I know usually any horseman lineup that's not one of the original two or three usually gets crapped on, but because I walked into wrestling at a time where this was the lineup, and it was, you know, it was Arn and Flair and Barry Windham. I know Sid was a little bit of a weird fit, but to me, I don't know, he wasn't any worse than having, say, Luger in there. I didn't think this was the worst Four Horsemen lineup of all time. Dan, what did you think?
No, I didn't think it was awful. You also had Barry Windham kind of in and out at this point, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of had the cookie cutter feel of a good faction. You had like the kind of main event guy. You had kind of, you know, the mid card guy, the TV champ in Arn. You had the big muscle with Sid still kind of learning the ropes a little bit here. And although he gets a huge, you know, elevation being in the title match for this particular pay-per-view, and then you know, the tried and true veteran of Barry. But I think because Barry's kind of in and out, and behind the scenes Ric Flair's having his issues with Jim Herd, this is kind of not a time that even the horsemen themselves want to kind of remember fondly. And of course, you obviously down the road you would have Sid and Arn's you know, issues, and for lack of a better term. So I don't know. It's kind of one of those. Let's just skip ahead. Let's move ahead to the next incarnation.
JT, if you don't count the original Horsemen, if you, let's say you skip over any 80s Horsemen incarnation, who's your favorite lineup of Four Horsemen? So of kind of the lesser groups.
I mean, I like this one because I thought Sid was good as the unstable muscle, and it's almost like at any moment he could snap and screw things up. So it's almost like they're working so hard to keep him paying attention and engaged, involved, because they know if they harness him, what they could do with him. And I'm always a big fan when Barry's involved in the Horsemen. This is in that kind of, you know, I think Dan struggled a little bit to maybe pinpoint his role, but it's like that Tully, the Phenom work rate role, and Arn's just the grizzled veteran. I like the Pillman one too, the Pillman Benoit Arn Flair from late 95. I thought that had a lot of juice, but because of what happened with Pillman's contract and the way he ended up leaving, Obviously, we didn't get a very good run with them. They, you know, they tried a little bit later. Like, I think in some ways Mongo is a little bit underrated because...
I was waiting for you to give some love to your boy Mongo.
Well, he's so over. If you watch those shows in 96 and 97, like, the crowd's super into him. And he was never great in the ring, but he sure had the charisma, and he really worked his ass off. Like, he didn't take the Horseman thing lightly. Like, you could tell he meant a lot to him to be a Four Horseman, so... I think he deserves a little bit of love, but yeah, those are probably some of my favorite versions.
I agree with you on all those points, but I still have never met a bigger Mongo fan than you.
Yeah, baby.
Well, should they have let the Horsemen die after they split apart for the first time? I mean, they brought them back so many times. It never seemed to work out quite as well. Should they have just, you know, they caught lightning in a bottle once. Should they have quit, or do you think, you know, why not give it another shot?
Okay, when you say first time, do you mean after Arn and Tully, or do you mean after Arn and Tully left?
No, I'm saying after Arn and Tully left. Like, let's consider that the Luger. I consider Luger and Wyndham part of that original generation of Horsemen. After Arn and Tully leave, that's when it ends.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, they should have left. In fact, a well-known bootlegger actually compiled all of the original Four Horsemen's run. And like this epic 41 disc set that's floating around there. And that's when it died for me. I know, you could probably trace that to when I stopped watching wrestling was around the time that the Horsemen finally dissolved, you know.
I was going to make the day the music died joke anyway, and then it kind of worked out beautifully right there. Because there was some music and then it died. Yeah. Anyway, that's all I got.
No, it's good stuff, man. Let's move on to the next match.
I had my mic on mute. Shit. I was talking, and I was like, why are these guys talking over me? No.
Let's hear it.
I want to bring up is that I'm actually going to give props to that whole Arn Anderson. He's crippled, but he's like a mouthpiece. Flair, Mongo, Benoit version. Because... And Nitro, which was so crowded with so many wrestlers trying to kind of get their acts over, the Horsemen felt important during that Monday Night War era. You know, do I like Mongo in the ring? No. You know, it's Benoit, Baby Killer, yes. But at that time, no, that Horseman felt important. That Horseman group felt important. They felt like they're a part of the show.
I agree.
I actually think that's better than this Sid version, you know, because the Sid version, Sid shouldn't have been a heel. He shouldn't have been a horseman. He should have been a face. Crowd loved him, you know. Could have been Goldberg, you know, way before he was Goldberg. So
that's an interesting way of looking at it. One of the matches this show is best known for is the next one we're going to talk about, and probably the last one we're going to talk about before we go to a break. And that is the Steiner Brothers. Who, I got to say, when I first saw the Steiner Brothers on WCW Saturday night, I was blown away. And to this day, they're one of my favorite teams just because they were so different from anything else I'd seen. And one of the things I actually noticed watching back this match and some of the other ones, one of the reasons they're different is they're not, even though they do double team maneuvers, they're not really a classic tag team. They're just two guys who go out and beat people up. So they're more Road Warriors mold, but with a little more finesse. And here they took on the Nasty Boys. They were defending the U.S. tag team titles. This is a match between four guys who just let it all hang out. All four have reputations for being very stiff in the ring, for not being afraid to hurt other people, if that's going to make it look good. And as a result, these guys are also all guys who are not afraid to, you know, take a receipt. They're happy to do it. You end up getting kind of half brawl, half wrestling match here. Jerry Sags gets busted open. It's really brutal stuff. I like this match, and I know it was the match that basically put the Nasty Boys on the map and, ironically enough, got them signed to WWF, where they'd migrate not long after this. JT, as a guy who's, you know, seen some good Steiner's matches, you know, I'm sure you've seen like the Hart Brothers match and some of their other classic matches. You've seen some good Nasty Boys matches, all their 94 stuff with Cactus and Sullivan and Max Payne. Where does this rank respectively as far as these two teams? Is one of their best matches against each other?
Yeah, so, and I want to backtrack way back to the open here, and when I mentioned how I said I didn't you know, remember much about WCW before this point, I actually remember seeing the Nasties in WCW. It's some vague corner of my mind. I like remember a Nasties match in WCW at some point in 1990, so I must have been somewhat aware. But anyway, I think for the Nasties, it is easily their best non like gimmick match, because you know, the match with Foley and Max Payne in 94 is awesome. I love that match. And obviously the one with Sullivan the next month is really good too. But those are just straight gimmick brawls. And there's a lot of brawling in this match, but it's still under the auspices of an actual match. So to me, this is easily the Nasty's best non-gimmick match. Steiners obviously have a much bigger catalog. They get the, you know, the match with Sting and Luger. They get the match with the Hart Brothers. You know, there's more there for them to pick through. I think it's up there for Steiner matches I've seen. It's a, you know, a great secondary title feud for teams that were kind of upcoming as well, but just a nasty match. I mean, they beat the crap out of each other, both with regular moves and with weapons, like some stiff chair shots and a great spike pile driver, and the atmosphere is just crazy as they're just beating the shit out of each other. I mean, when I watched this, I don't know, like 6 months ago for the first time in probably a long time, if maybe even ever, I was just floored by how awesome it was. And when we picked this show, I was so pumped to watch it again. To me, it ends up definitely clocking in a match of the night. I would have it around 4 stars. Like, I thought it was just fantastic. I mean, I would easily the Steiner's best. I mean, easily the Nasty's best match, non-gimmick division. And it's up there for the Steiners with the stuff I've seen.
Even the Frankensteiner that Scott finishes knobs with is just gross looking.
Almost
looks like
just murders him.
Yeah, just plants them right on his head, and they all just get back out. I mean, there's a post-match angle where the Nasty Boys dress up as in concessions. I mean, there must have been some stuff. There must have been a match cut out here or something, because they're, you know, already backstage as concession workers and come out and do it. But
yeah, so there's like 4 matches that we didn't see.
Okay,
that are after this before our next one. Because I remember thinking, I even noted it before I realized at first that this was cut down, that there were 4 straight tag matches to open the show. I'm like, that seems weird. I mean, as it was, there were 3 of them, but. I think it must have happened probably during one of the in between, because I thought it was weird too watching it. Like, why is Scott there? How did they already get into concession
so
worker
quickly.
Outfits?
Yeah. All right. So I talked a little bit about the Steiners and how they're a different sort of tag team. I think they're a little more emblematic of the, like we said when we talked about the opening match, you know, transitioning from that 80s style tag to the Dooms and the Steiner brothers, and, you know, even eventually going on to guys like Harlem Heat, who are much just bigger guys who could do some tandem moves. Will, what's your take on kind of the shift? Because you talked earlier about how the Midnight Express felt a little passe at this point. Where do you rank the Steiners in terms of the all-time list of tag team wrestling? Because I know they're maybe not be going too far to say they're a controversial team. They're not on everyone's all-time list, but they're on some people's.
Well, here's how I compare the Steiners. I compare them to carbonated soda. It's empty calories. Okay, and what I mean by that is they do a lot of stiff moves, they do a lot of cool high impact moves, but they leave me feeling empty, in the sense that, like, the first tag match, you know, despite the finish, that's right up my alley, man. That's classic tag team formula wrestling, old Southern style tag team wrestling, right up my alley. Now, I admit, man, I'm an old man. You know what I mean? Even back then, I was kind of an old soul, you know? And so for me to watch the Steiners, no, I can appreciate what they were doing. And, hey, everything kind of moves forward. I don't think it's always necessarily progress, but everything moves forward. We see it today. I mean, you have to accept certain standards in today's wrestling to get into it. That and accept that things that you enjoy from past wrestling, it's not coming back. I'm a blood guy. I'm a vampire. I know blood's not coming back. So I have to accept that if I'm going to enjoy today's wrestling. You know, I'm going to have to accept that, you know, WWE has a certain formula that they like to work. And within that formula, can I appreciate it? So with the Steiners, I know what I'm getting. I'm getting a bunch of head drops. I'm getting a bunch of stiff shots. And, man, they beat the shit out of the Nasty Boys. You know, you always hear about the Steiners roughing up their opponents, but the way the Nasty Boys always have these kind of, like, insane brawls, I just get the feeling that a lot of people just didn't like the Nasty Boys. You know, I'm sure the Nasties gave as much as they get, but the Steiners really beat the shit out of this team on the show. You know, I just have a feeling that they were not loved even as early as 1990. As far as where I would rank the Steiners, I don't have them in my top 10, man. I mean, it's just not my style, you know, and I, you know, that's the thing, man. I mean, a lot of people would never have Jerry Lawler in their top 20. Memphis wrestling is not their style of wrestling. They don't appreciate it. I can't change that. You know, I'm not a big Kurt Angle guy. I consider him like the Steiner singles guy of the last 15 years, you know, empty calories. That's what I consider him. And I understand I have different opinions than other people. I don't have opinions that kind of fit the consensus, but I enjoy the Steiners. I enjoy them more in Japan, you know, but I wouldn't have them in my top 10, 15, maybe top 25, because I do enjoy them, you know.
Yeah,
just not my favorite style.
The empty calories thing is it's actually a really good way to put it, because I love the Steiners and I love watching the Steiners, but for the life of me, if I had to make a case for why they're one of the top 10 tag teams of all time, I don't know that I could do it other than just saying, well, I like watching them.
Yeah, and then the number of great matches, right? Like, you know, I could probably list about 30 Midnight Express matches over the years that I could consider great. I don't know if I can do that with the Steiners, you know. Maybe 10, you know. And so they have, like, these neat performances. And my buddy Rob Naylor always likes to talk about the way they would just destroy jobbers.
I was going to say that. You know? Yeah, the great squash,
their squash matches. Great, incredibly,
yeah,
great
squash match. But you know, the Midnight Express always had cool squash matches too, because Cornette would interact with the jobbers, but it was just a different type of squash, you know. And so I enjoy watching them, but I don't necessarily enjoy that style of tag wrestling. It's not just what I want out of my wrestling. So.
I mean, you could argue that they're awful pro wrestlers because they're really beating the shit out of people. I mean, you could, right? I mean, you could.
That's true.
They're fun to watch because it's you're watching a fight. I mean, at our hearts, we enjoy watching fighting, I guess. But
sure,
they
violence for the sake of violence.
And you could say the same thing for the Nasty Boys. I mean, they work stiff and they're not. But so, you know, a guy like, you always hear like Bret Hart talk about the point of wrestling isn't to injure the other guy. But these two teams don't seem to give a shit or prescribe to that, you know, theory, because they're just out there hammering each other with vicious shots and aren't pulling any punches.
Let's talk about the Nasty Boys, Dan. If you're Vince McMahon, you're watching, say, this match, or you're someone who works for Vince McMahon, what compels you to sign the Nasty Boys? Is it just to get them away from the NWA, or is there something in this match that you saw with the Nasties? Because this is, I mean, if this match doesn't happen, arguably the Nasties do not have the run they have throughout the 90s. They don't become WWF Tag Team Champions. They don't become WCW Tag Team Champions down the line. What is it about the Nasty Boys that made them an appealing team? Because with the Steiners, you know, you can see it right there. Whether they're empty calories or not, they're two muscled up dudes with the amateur skills who are dropping people on people's heads. They're fun to watch. With the Nasties, I feel like it's a little more beneath the surface. So sell me on the Nasty Boys, Dan.
Well, I mean, they have the look. They have the look as very cartoony, very colorful characters, kind of like the foils to a superhero, which is what Vince was looking for on his roster, was the next superhero, the next comic book character. They had, you know, obviously a marketing appeal with those shirts. I think the Nasty Boy shirts really was kind of different from what you were seeing from other teams. It wasn't, you know, like some poorly drawn cartoony looking thing. It was, you know, you had like kind of the spray paint, and it really just kind of fit those two guys. You could see these guys being two guys that you would want to steer clear of at the bar, you know, because they would probably going to start some trouble. And they really did take a pounding in this match. They just went with it. They rolled. I mean, one guy has this gash on his head. He's just, whatever, I'm just going to grab this chair and I'm just going to start swinging away. So, I mean, it wasn't necessarily, they were almost kind of ahead of their time, you know, and they would have definitely, and they certainly, we saw it down the road when things got into more hardcore and weapons and that sort of thing. But it's weird looking at this match, because it just seems so real. I liked Will's point about these guys really were beating on one another. It's almost as if the Nasties had, like, owed the Steiners money the way that the Steiners were going after their opponents in this match. But then later on, they just kind of took this same type of feel, the same type of brawl, and made it really kind of hokey. And they had, like, you know, the hot dog vendors and the mustard and the ketchup and all the and the souvenirs and throwing things. And it just was a different feel. This seemed more raw. This seemed more just edgy. I like your point too. You know, this card is just loaded with tag teams. Seems like the NWA was really big into just stocking up on different tag teams. Vince probably wanted to just have a little bit of his own, given what he saw. If he did see this, that I could see why the Nasties would be appealing to them.
All right, guys, we're about halfway through the show. We got, well, not counting all those matches we didn't watch. We got three big title matches left, but before we get to those, let's take a moment to hear from all the other great shows at Place to Be Nation at Pro Wrestling Only. My name is Ben Morris. We will be right back here on the other end of Place to Be Nation Rewind, listening to Halloween Havoc 1990. Catch you guys in just a sec.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of the Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including Main Event, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Phil Schneider's Digging in the Crates, and our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse. And join Pro Wrestling Only's Will and I on the Dangerous Alliance podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to enjoy as well. We feature the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops, and the TJ McClune Show, featuring great guests from around the world of sports journalism. PTBN also proudly features the Richard the Mailman Podcast, specializing in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows available on PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN also is a home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keith's RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only, Place to Be Nation, Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's tag teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to PTBN Rewind. My name is Ben Morse. We are talking about Halloween Havoc 1990. It is a crossover episode with the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. That's right. We got all three of them here. We got JT. We got good old Will from Texas. We got Dangerous Dan McGinn. We're having a lot of fun. We're talking about Halloween Havoc 1990. Please listen to all the other great shows that we just mentioned on the break, all the Place to Be Nation shows, all the Pro Wrestling Only shows, and especially Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. But we are going to talk more about the card from 1990 that we have been discussing. And the next match on this one, it's for the World Tag Team titles, the NWA World Tag Team titles, held by Doom. And the challengers here are two members of the Four Horsemen, Arn Anderson and Ric Flair, who one of the things I like that they do here is they detail Flair's history as a tag team wrestler, his team with Greg Valentine, some of his past accomplishments. But how did this match come about, Dan McGinn?
Around this time, they kind of wheeled out the top 10 for the championship and the tag team championship. And the combination of Flair and Anderson was climbing the charts, as it were. We already saw the Steiners and Nasties in this, so they kind of sent Flair down a little bit on the card because he wasn't involved in the U.S. title or the obviously the World Heavyweight title. So they still wanted to obviously have him on the card, still a big name, and obviously the Horsemen are still relevant. And so they put together this kind of heel versus heel matchup. We've already seen a ton of tag teams today, a lot of the face tag teams already in action. So we have Doom with Teddy Long, and bringing out once again the unmasked Simmons and Butch Reed to take on Flair and Anderson. And when I was watching this, and when I was a kid, when I was 9 years old, it was just sort of like, okay, this is another tag match. And I hated Ric Flair so much during this time period when I was growing up. I'd seen him mess with the Von Erichs at WCW, at World Class, and I've seen him now mess with Sting, and I'm just kind of like, I'm supposed to hate this guy. The fans really love the Horsemen, but it was really weird for me being like, I now have to cheer for Doom. I guess I'll do it. It just kind of worked out that way. Like, all right, I'll cheer for Doom, and I think that's what happened during the course of this match. Mm-hmm. Each team tried to out-heal the other, and it was really kind of odd watching this because you're not really sure who you're supposed to root for, but both are doing an excellent job at what they're doing.
This, I had no clue. Like, between the commentary and the crowd, I was like, I don't know I don't know who the heel is supposed to. I went back and forth like 10 times. I just assumed it was Flair and Arn, and then I'm like, oh, maybe Doom's the face, and then I'm like, oh, maybe no one's a face. I don't know.
It makes me want to watch the Starrcade 90 match again, because I always assumed that Barry and Arn were playing the faces in that one, but I could be completely wrong on that. But I just know that brawl that they had at Starrcade 90. I always thought that Barry and Arn were playing the faces, but I might be completely off base on that. It might have been Doom.
I felt like in this match, Doom became the de facto faces, and part of that is because the way they distinguish is really, it becomes a power versus skill match. It becomes the explosive high impact guys going up against the crafty veterans. And for me, 9 times out of 10, the guys who are doing the explosive moves, that's who the crowd's going to cheer for. So that's kind of the sense I got.
And two things I loved on the commentary. I like how when Simmons got trapped in the heat segment, they explained that he was the least experienced of the four, and that's why they were able to corral him. So I like that. It explained why the Horsemen overcame that power and were able to lock him in. And then I love, too, how Heyman talks all about how Doom got suckered in by Flair and Arn because Doom didn't realize how adept Flair was at tag wrestling. So I think that's what we mentioned earlier. But I love those 2 points of commentary that really kind of helped tell the story.
I think this is probably the high point for the commentary team. I think this is their best match on commentary. And they're good all night. But yeah I agree.
I think this is the high point of the show. I mean, I think this is the best match on the show by far.
I don't disagree with you on that either. This was the Steiners and Nasties was fun, but this was on a different level. And I remember the show being more known for the Steiners and Nasties. And maybe that's because, and I got to go back and watch that Starrcade 90 match again myself, because I remember that being a really good match too. And I'm not sure which was the better Horseman Doom match, but this is great. I mean, it's, you get wrestling in there, you get brawling in there. It's long. They end up going to a double countout. There's no conclusive finish. It's a really, really solid match. And Doom hangs with Flair and Anderson, who are just two of the best of all time. Will, I asked you about the Steiners and where they fit into that all-time discussion. I feel like Doom is not a team that always gets mentioned. Maybe that's because they had a really short run. They're really only around for 89 and 90. But, I mean, they were a great team while they were around. And though they were power guys, they were able to hang with guys like Flair and Anderson. Where did they fall for you on your personal preference?
Well, they're probably lower than the Steiners, but one, because mm-hmm. I mean they did not team long. But yes. I will say this about Butch Reed, and I've said this before many times. For me, by far, if you ever get a chance to watch his Mid-South stuff, or maybe even some of his stuff from like Florida, or some of his early stuff when he was, I think he was Bruce Reed before he was Butch Reed, right? Am I wrong in that?
If you don't know it, none of us is going to know it.
No, well I mean, say that. Where's Chris Zellner when I need him? God damn it. but Butch Reed, for my money, the best African-American wrestler of all time, you know, and the only guy I know to get not one, but two great classic matches out of Junkyard Dog, like singles matches, legitimately great matches. Butch Reed really was a great wrestler. This is a guy who could go 30 minutes with Flair, go 45 minutes with Dick Murdoch, get great matches out of Junkyard Dog, or have like bloody brawls. He could work the mat. Not a great mat worker, but competent, and of course a great power guy. But really, for my money, the best African-American wrestler we've ever seen on tape.
JT, we talked about Flair as a tag team wrestler as far as the announcers are saying it. But watching this match, how did you think Flair adapted to being in a tag team match? Because obviously, they can give all the lip service they want to stuff he did in the past. But he is a guy who is primarily a singles. At this point in his career, had been wrestling singles for about a decade. How do you think he slipped into the tag formula? Granted, he has Arn Anderson, who... Will, when you do that podcast, I would be shocked if Arn's not in the discussion for best tag team wrestlers of all time. But
he's top five.
Yeah, he's got to be. But JT, how do you think Flair acquitted himself as a tag team wrestler here?
First off, I'd say Akeem was the best African-American wrestler of all time. But I think he adapted really well. And I just think he's a really damn good pro wrestler. And whether he's the greatest of all time or not, I'll leave that up to Parv to argue about. But I think that... He knows what he's doing, and it's no surprise to me. Go listen to the other show. It's no surprise to me that he's able to slip in and out of those roles. And when you have the history he does with Arn, even if they haven't been a tag team, they've been a team for 5 years at this point. So they know each other well. It may flay with someone else a little bit different, but I don't think so. I just think he's so adept at wrestling that he just knows what he's doing.
Well, JT, remember, there goes Basil. Remember, back in 1987 when they were doing the tournament, Luger was still young. They paired Luger with Flair.
Yep.
And that wasn't by mistake. And, you got to remember, too, Flair had like a great tag team with Greg Valentine back in the 70s. So they were known as a really good tag team. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that Flair could be a great tag wrestler. Problem was, he was always so entrenched in the world title matches that you don't really get a sense of where Flair stands in that all-time list, Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good enough to be in the top five of greatest wrestlers of all time. Leave it to other people to be the greatest tag wrestlers. But yeah, Flair's awesome.
This was the, like we said, if you're watching the clip version of the show, it's the fourth tag team match in a row. Tag teams were so much more of a thing in 1990, but I'll ask you, Dan, because, you were watching both products at the time. How did the NWA tag division, especially as you're revisiting it here, stack up against WWF's tag team division, which I'm gonna keep Will out of this discussion because I know how he feels about most early 90s WWF tag teams.
Hey, the Rockers were awesome, man.
The Rockers were great. But, Dan McGinn, what did you think about NWA tag teams versus WWF tag teams?
Well, I think during this time period, it was very deep. I mean, they even had two tag team champions, if you will. You had the U.S. and then the world. And at any time, the Steiners were competing against Doom or the Freebirds were were the champions, lost to the Steiners, but then were competing for the U.S. tag team titles. The Midnights were involved, the Rock and Roll Express. It was very deep, and you always kind of felt like even though if a team was competing for the U.S. title, U.S. tag titles, it wouldn't be long before they'd be competing for the world tag team titles, too. They were all kind of interchangeable. I mean, unless you're looking at teams like the Master Blasters or Maximum Overdrive or something like that, you were looking at teams that could legitimately be headlining the tag division at any given time. And it was kind of interesting because I almost thought that maybe like, oh, are they going to throw Flair a bone here and maybe have him and Arn have a little run with the titles because, you know, he's not the world champion anymore, but he's still name recognition and the draw for most of this year. So, but Doom was really popular at the time too. So they, in this situation, it was really hard to decipher between well, where they wanted to go. And obviously Flair was going to still be involved in the title picture, whether, you know, one way or the other. But but then you look at the WWF side and yeah, you had the Hearts and eventually the Road Warriors would join up and you had Demolition. But then you also had guys, teams that you wouldn't necessarily assume would be competing for the tag titles. Like I never really thought that the Orient Express in the tag team championship. We never thought that the Bolsheviks were going to win the tag team title. So I think there was a much deeper roster to deal with the tag teams, but they also probably put a lot more emphasis on the tags than Vince was, even at this time.
How dare you sleep on both Maximum Overdrive and the Orient Express, sir? You should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, Orient Express rocked.
All right, so finally transitioning out of tag teams, we have two singles matches to close this show. Both for titles. The first one for the NWA United States title, Lex Luger, who had held the belt for well over a year at this point, defending against a kind of out of left field challenger in Stan Hansen. Again, Dan, I'm going to turn to you and see if we can get a little background on how this kind of odd pairing came about.
Well, during this time with Ole doing a lot of the booking and hiring and that sort of thing, you saw a lot of veteran guys come onto the roster. As I was kind of chronicling 1990, I mean, there were shows like Clashes that had guys like Iron Sheik on there, Dutch Mantell, and then you'd have guys like Vader come in. You saw guys like Bam Bam go from the NWA to Japan. So you'd always kind of see guys coming in and out for brief stints and that sort of thing. And one of the guys that kind of veteran guys that found his way on the roster was Hansen. And I don't remember, I think it was actually the Clash right before this. Hansen, he just annihilated the Z-Man, which was kind of Tom Zenk's role at this point. And then later on in the show, he interfered in a United States title match between Lex Luger and Ric Flair. It was actually a really good match.
Yeah,
and then
excellent match.
The ending got a little screwy with the Lariat coming out and just beating the hell out of Lex Luger. So that kind of set up what we saw in this match here. Hansen did cut a promo kind of like in this kind of festive Halloween, almost as if he was being interviewed at like some sort of pumpkin farm or whatever, and he spits the tobacco into the pumpkin saying, "This is what I'm going to do to you, Lex Luger." And it was just crazy. And I just remember watching this as a kid thinking, well, Lex Luger is one of the biggest names in the company. I mean, heck, he had the little ghost face coming in during the intro. He's up there with Sting on the card. He has the U.S. title. He has this kind of larger than life persona, almost as if he's kind of like the second big face on the card. There's no way he's going to lose to this kind of crazy out of sorts, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but this kind of crazy out of sorts, unorthodox cowboy character, right? And then, of course, as we saw in this match, it was almost like jaw-dropping what happens at the end. But yeah, there definitely was a little bit of a build, but it was part of this kind of let's get some veteran guys back on the roster, even if it's for a short run.
Well, was Stan Hansen a viable contender at this point? Was he a guy you could buy as a threat to someone as young and, you know, hungry as Lex Luger? Were Hansen's best years way behind him at this point?
No, Hansen's always a threat. Mm-hmm. Now, what was his peak there? Yeah, maybe, but then he goes as a match of the year contenders in All Japan in like 92 and 93, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was really great up until like 98 or around the time he retired. I love Stan Hansen. He's one of my top 20 wrestlers of all time. Excuse me. I'm choking on a peanut right now. Sorry about that.
Would anybody like a peanut?
Yeah, exactly. But, man, the other day, man, I had an apple, a piece of apple lodged in my throat. I almost didn't make the show because I was almost dead. But anyway, whatever. But
I'm glad you didn't die, Will.
Hansen, to me, it's almost criminal the way they used Hansen, because he should have been facing Lex Luger. Him and Flair should have been battling over the belt. I think we were kind of robbed of one of the great all-time rivalries. We always look at like Ric Flair's peak from like the 70s until 1989, you know, when he had the great Steamboat and Funk matches. I almost feel like, you know, even though Ric Flair was really good in 1990, that we were robbed of like the next great rivalry and like the Stan Hansen Ric Flair feud, you know, because Stan Hansen could go with anybody, you know, at this time.
What do you think about him and Flair in particular would have made for a good feud?
Well, you're going to have the Big Hoss Texan. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine Dusty Rhodes, who could work. You know what I mean?
Dusty Rhodes.
A scary Dusty Rhodes who could work, who also has his own charisma. You know what I mean? Who, on any given night, man, you whip out that lariat, he's going to knock you out. And I've seen Stan Hansen take out a lot of guys with nasty lariats. I don't know if WCW wanted Stan Hansen to wrestle like he was in All Japan, but they let the Steiners work the same way. So why not Stan Hansen, you know? And both guys are pros enough. I think Flair and Hansen would have had an all-time classic series.
Interesting. I mean, I think we get a decent match here with Luger. I think we have distant series with Luger. This is arguably Luger at his peak. I mean, 89-90 Luger. People always shit on Luger, you know, say he didn't have the passion for the business, he didn't have the skills. But I think by 1989-90, he was putting on some good matches.
He had great matches as early as 87, you know, when he was green. The thing is, Luger really didn't drop off until, you know, as a worker until he went to WWF, like so many other great workers who drop off when they go up north.
Right. Well, he also had the injury, to be fair. He had the motorcycle accident.
Fair enough.
Don't know how much that affecting him, but we get kind of it's an all over the place ending here. We get a good brawl for the match and some great stuff, and I agree, Hansen's just entertaining as hell. He when you said he had his own charisma, that was a really good way of putting it. He has a crazy charisma that's uniquely him that can't really be matched. They end up doing a title switch here, which I don't think a lot of people were expecting. They were expecting Hansen to just be another guy for Luger to mow down, but Dan Spivey, who's Hansen's protege, they do some lip service to that on the announcer's side, gets involved. Hansen hits the lariat, gets the 1-2-3 title switch. JT, as a booking analysis here, why do you think they switched the U.S. title? Why is it because they knew they weren't going to be moving any other championships? Did they want to spice up Luger's character a little? Was Hansen just that good? If you were to guess, why do you think they moved the U.S. title here?
I think two things. I think one, to have a title change for the show to help sell the idea of pay-per-view. But I think two, it gave Luger a story to head towards Starrcade. And yeah, everyone, you know, we talked about it before, having the face chase was an NWA thing. So I think getting it on a veteran heel like that, letting Luger kind of gain his reps and trying to get it back from him, then you know, having him win at the, you know, big final show of the year was probably the plan. I think it was just, okay, let's get it off him for a couple months, let him kind of chase and reestablish himself as a player. So I thought it was fine. I'm glad Spivey didn't cause the finish. He kind of comes out and backfires, and then Hansen wins anyway. So at least it made it a little more clean than having Spivey, because we've already had a couple. Like, we didn't talk really about the finish of the Doom match, but I got why they did it, but I wasn't a fan after like an 18-minute match. I just kind of walked to the back. you didn't want to come off of that with like another, okay, here's another screwy finish. So they had Spivey come out, backfire, and then Hansen get the win a few minutes, a few seconds later. But yeah, I mean, overall, I thought it was pretty good. I like Dan's point too about how Hansen kind of fit that Halloween style. The whole pay per view felt a little wild and weird, and Hansen was like a perfect fit for that. And I liked having the good, kind of, you know, handsome, strong, clean cut Luger against this nasty pig veteran of Hansen's, just spewing everything out and sloppy and, you know, just messy looking. So I thought that was a pretty cool.
The original Phineas Godwin right here. Huh?
Right. Just a big fat sloppy pig, as someone once said. But no, I thought that looked well too. That was cool too, because they were such dichotomies of each other. That played a role in the match. Oh yeah, this was good. And again, the finish was good too, the way they did where Hansen popped up and hit the lariat right before the torture rack.
Yeah, and it's funny because Hansen doesn't even like go down the ring ramp. I mean, he goes down off the side and he's whipping his bell around and yelling at kids and everything. And 9-year-old Dan would have been like, I hope he doesn't see me through the screen. I hope he doesn't hit me with that bell, you know. And like I said, when he won, when he hits that lariat, and Ross really built up the lariat during this match, talking about how he only uses his left arm and it's all well padded up, and when he hits you with that, it's lights out and that sort of thing, and it came true. I mean, you're watching that match and you're like, well, Lex Luger can overcome a clothesline, but then when he actually did take that hit, I mean, he went down like a sack of potatoes, and then it was 1, 2, 3, and 9-year-old Dan, and even to a certain extent, 34-year-old Dan's watching that match like, I still cannot believe Lex Luger loses this match. But now that, you know, you know a little bit more about Stan Hansen, and Luger had basically a stranglehold on that belt for the entire year to this point, and had a couple really close calls of possibly winning the world title against Ric Flair. So maybe it was time for him to kind of relinquish the belt for a short time. But man, oh man, it came as quite a shock. And I certainly do agree with the point that you didn't change the tag titles. You had a chance. I don't think anybody would have complained too terribly if the Nasties beat the Steiners for the U.S. tag titles. The TV title obviously wasn't on the line. So it was kind of a good call, I guess, to have a title change in this situation.
Now, if the show ends here, I think it was a pretty good run. I mean, granted, again, we didn't see some of the squash matches, and Freebirds Renegade Warriors wasn't anything to write home about, but it was pretty short. But you still have the main event to talk about. Sting defending against Sid Vicious. Some people have said over the years, I think Will, you're one of them, have cut down Sting a little bit, said he's not the best worker. I don't think he's one of the greatest workers of all times. I think he has had a lot of good matches based on the fact that when he's in the ring with someone who can go, he can go. He can keep up. Sid is not one of those guys. Sid has to be carried to a good match, and that's the one thing I think is a mark against Sting, as I don't think he's really carried someone who's not very good to a
Never.
Good match. Yeah, and he doesn't do it here. Unfortunately, I think the show ends on a bit of a sour note for a few reasons. First of all, to give a little background on this match, it's basically a continuation of Sting's feud with the Four Horsemen. He took the title from Flair, so now Flair is sending the muscle after him in Sid. And yeah, that's pretty much the setup for the match. Dan, you can tell me if I missed anything, but that was pretty much the premise, right?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. And but in the meantime, you had that Black Scorpion angle kind of
right.
Looming in the background. So in a way, Sid almost feels like an afterthought at times. And then at other times, it's like, oh yeah, Sid's competing for the title. But I think Parv made an awesome point. If you listen back to the show where the big boys play, it's like, as far as kayfabe goes, as far as the storytelling goes, it's really kind of odd that Flair was and the Horsemen weren't cool with Sting accepting the title match to face Flair for the title. But now Flair's kind of like, yeah, you know what, Sid, you can go for the title. That's fine. You know, so instead of having Flair being your real world's champion, he's like, you know what, let's Sid see if he can win the belt from Sting. It's very odd. And I kind of like that point. But at the same time, looking at like what Sid had done leading up to this, I mean, he was part of that kind of odd six-man that involved the kind of debuting El Gigante with the dudes with attitudes. He lost in like 30 seconds against Lex Luger in a U.S. title match on a Clash. So heading in, if you looked at kind of what he did on the other supercards, it's kind of an odd choice. But if you're kind of going on the story of, well, the Horsemen want to send their big gun to take out Sting, I guess it makes sense.
Justin, I want to talk to you about something we've talked about in the past, and that is, strangely enough, the booking The Ultimate Warrior during this time, during 1990. There's a little bit of a parallel because he and Sting were partners way back in the day, and I know you and I have agreed that Warrior got kind of sandbagged when it came to being WWF champion. He took the belt from Hogan, and then was not programmed against top guys. There was really no one for him to feud with. And when a business eventually went under, it's hard to tell, was that Warrior's fault or was he just set up to fail? Now, on the flip side, over in the NWA, you got Sting, who's been waiting forever to get this belt, finally gets it from Flair, immediately gets thrown into this screwy angle with the Black Scorpion, is put in the ring with guys who cannot bring him up in terms of Sid. When you compare Warrior and Sting, is it a similar situation where you think Sting just wasn't given the support, or was the NWA just not competent? Basically, I want to hear you compare and contrast Sting and Warrior, because I think it's an interesting comparison at this point.
See, I think Warrior got hosed a little bit more because maybe WCW just wasn't great at booking face world champions. I mean, I know Flair kind of was at times, but for the majority of his run, he was a heel. And you look at the faces that had runs, they were all very short. Like Dusty was, what, not even a month. Garvin was a few months, and he was barely on TV. So it's almost like they get in that position, then they're not sure what to do. Then, all right, what do we do now? Okay, let's make up this weird magician to feud with Sting. It was just an odd direction. And I kind of like Sting running through the Horsemen. Like, that seemed to make sense. Like, have him fight Sid here, and then maybe he fights Arn at a show, and then he gets another match with Flair. But Warrior, on the other hand, is with a company that knows exactly how to book champions like him. But I think two things happened. One, Hogan and even Warrior himself had beaten a lot of the contenders leading up to WrestleMania 6. And that match was booked as such a monumental clash of the two top guys that it's hard to come back from that to say, all right, well, Warrior just knocked off Hogan clean in this mammoth show. Why would I believe that anyone could defeat him for the belt at this point? Like, why am I going to believe Rick Rude, who Warrior just beat 6 months ago and has done nothing since then, is like this legit world title contender against a guy that just wrecked Hogan at WrestleMania? So it was a tough spot for him to be in. And they had a guy that could have been a really legitimate challenger for him, and that's the Earthquake. Have him lay out Hogan, and Warrior comes on Hogan's behalf and fights Quake. But they wanted to keep Quake strong for Hogan to come back and fight, so that left Warrior really with nothing. I mean, I think their best bet, because Perfect, as great as he was, just wasn't believable enough at that point. DiBiase's star had dimmed a bit, and Rude had already been beaten by Warrior anyway. So, and I mean, you got guys like Andre, he's done. So it's like, who else is really there? And Warrior had beaten him anyway. I think the best bet may have been to try and poach someone from WCW to come in as a threat. Just like someone we hadn't seen get wiped out before. And someone that could have been more believable as a threat for Warrior. Because it was no one. And then after SummerSlam, they got him stuck in tags. You know, six-man tags with LOD and Demolition. And Hogan's clearly being presented as a top guy. And then by the time Savage is rehabbed enough, you know, they're ready to take the belt off Warrior and get it back to Hogan. So, like, Savage was a guy that they could have maybe used, but he was busy over the summer with Dusty, and he had been damaged so much that I'm not sure anyone was ready to buy him as a contender. I just think Hogan and Warrior were put on such a pedestal that it was hard to believe anyone else could do it. I feel like maybe they had the same problem after WrestleMania 3, too. Like, I think they got, you know, I mean, the Orndorff thing had pretty much settled. Like, who does Hogan even really... He pretty much is still programmed with Andre, right? I mean, he has little throwaway matches here and there on the house shows, but, he still had Andre to feud with. Warrior couldn't do that. Couldn't still feud with Hogan. So it was just... I don't know. It felt like it was just... They built these guys up as such superheroes, and there was no one that was really believable on the roster to even compete with Warrior.
I will say this about PTN BN Rewind, people. If you listen to Where the Big Boys Play, I guarantee they did not analyze the Ultimate Warriors WWF title reign during their Halloween Havoc episode as much as we just did.
So broke it down for a bit.
That was beautiful.
Break it all down. Let's go back around.
Well, talking about Sid, you mentioned way back when we were talking about the Horseman lineup how you thought Sid should have been a babyface. Do you think Sid would have been a better choice to carry the title than Sting? Could he have been the big babyface star they needed? Could he have been carried by guys like Flair maybe had a credible reign?
No. Well, the problem is that you're a company that's being booked by guys who are thinking like it's 1980 or 78. You know what I mean? I think there's Ole Anderson, right?
Yes.
So, I mean... I have a whole problem with the NWA's concept of heel champions anyway. You know, there's something, and JR knows I'm not a huge WWF guy at all. But one thing I'll give Vince credit for and I'll give his father credit for, they went with the babyface champion who knocked off all comers. You know what I mean? Like, it was a babyface territory, and the babyface had his hand held high at the end. Even back when wrestling was in the smoky smoke-filled arenas, everybody knew wrestling was fake. You know what I mean? But you want escapism in your wrestling, and you want that baby face raising the belt at the end that the crowd can cheer for. Go home, go, you know, be happy, and then go back to your miserable lives until the next live show. You know what I mean? It's escapism. And the way they booked, there's no way, because they would have expected them to do 30 minutes. As we've seen with Ronda Rousey, we saw with Mike Tyson, who was hugely popular. I don't know. Had he been knocked out by Buster Douglas by this time, 1990?
Yeah, February 90.
Yeah.
Okay, so but still, Tyson had an amazing run, right, where he knocked fools out in the first round. Okay, we saw it with Goldberg on his rise to popularity. I mean, you put Sid Vicious in the ring for like 3 minutes against somebody and have him just powerbomb the shit out of people, people are going to go nuts. You know what I mean? It's completely different from what anyone's doing. It's the next killer who, you know, and then when Sid's finally able to go a little bit longer, it's like, wow, this guy actually took Sid to like the 10-minute mark. You know what I mean? Or make it another mark. Oh, wow, this guy took Sid to 5 minutes. This guy took Sid to 10 minutes. You know, or something, or this guy, you know, was able to survive Sid for 20 minutes and finally Sid, who's just not used to that, and have the cardio play up. Maybe then you have Sid drop the belt because he didn't have the cardio. And then if you still have faith in Sid, which company probably wouldn't, he'd probably leave by that time anyway, then you do it. Now, I don't know if Sid was mature enough to be champion. I don't know. You know, I'm pretty sure he wasn't. But at the same time, I would have never booked Sid the way they booked him anyway. I mean, the guy was over. I mean, some guys just, they have charisma. The crowd attracts to them like flies, and you got to run with it. You know what I mean? Whether they're my favorite wrestler or not, you got to run with it. I would have never booked Sid the way they booked him. I would have thrown away that outdated mode of the money's in the chase, because I don't think it is. I think the money is in the hero standing tall at the end. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the territories didn't exist anymore where your hometown babyface could fight the evil touring champion. I think it's an outdated way of looking. Even in 1990, I thought it was outdated. It was narrow-sighted to think that a world champion only has to fight one way, which is that classic NWA 30-minute draw, 60-minute draw type champion. You know, and Flair's great at that role. Don't get me wrong. But I think it needed to be something new and different. You know, even the Warrior was, I think, booked bad, you know, as JR alluded to, you know. Warrior should have just kept on squashing motherfuckers because that's what people loved about him. You know what I mean? That's what people love about Ronda Rousey. Nobody wants to see Ronda Rousey go five rounds. You want to see her get a girl and tap her out in 30 seconds, you know. And then you have the strong undercard to kind of make up for the fact that your world champion's only going to go 5 minutes.
Yeah, I like that idea. They should have just had Warrior mow through guys for the summer and not – I mean, and they kind of did, but, I mean, really mow through them and then find some – I mean, maybe they bring Sid in sooner than they did. Maybe they can grab him from WCW at the end of 90 instead of waiting to 91 and let him come in. I mean, they had Barry Windham on the roster in late 89. If you build him up properly, he has the build and look to maybe hang with Warrior in a role like that. I mean, maybe you can steal Luger. Like, I feel like they needed someone new to be the one that finally got in Warrior's way. If they weren't going to use Earthquake in that way, and, you know, they brought Undertaker at the end of the year, but he wasn't ready at all by that, you know, that soon, so.
But do you agree, though, that, I mean, that they were so set in their ways that they really didn't, like, see this, like, charismatic figure who I think, I don't know if Sid could have turned it around, but he just felt so different. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, you know, the match is going to suck. So you don't want it to go long anyway, right? You'd rather watch like a 3 minute squash or a quick 3 minute wild fight than you'd rather see a 10 minute boring match or horrible match where they just keep blowing moves. Right. I mean, why not? Why not push them like Mike Tyson or, you know, this super killer, you know? I don't know. That's how I would have approached the situation, you know. But I wasn't behind the scenes in the locker room, so who am I?
Dan, I made you explain the Black Scorpion earlier. You're welcome. I also want you to walk us through the incredibly convoluted finish of this match.
Oh, okay.
That is your next challenge. You're usually the one giving out the challenges. I'm going to give you the challenge here.
Poor Dan.
So, Sting's on the outside, and Sid as well, and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, Arn and Rick come out as well. So I don't know if people realize this, although if you've watched the show in its entirety, you'll know that there's the entrance rampway, and then there's the kind of off to the side row that the wrestlers exit the area from. So Sting and Sid are fighting up that. You see Arn and Rick, they don't really touch anybody, but they're kind of just talking to the ref, and they're there, and next thing you know, Sid comes back in, and Sting apparently comes back in as well, and Sting attempts to jump Sid from behind and tries to lift him up, and then can't lift him up for some reason. Sting, almost like Samson, he cut his hair off or whatever, and he loses all his strength, and then splat, and then the cover, 1, 2, 3. And again, if I thought the last match was jaw-dropping as a 9-year-old, imagine the horror I had in my eyes, in my face. I just lost all control of my bodily functions at this point, because now the balloons are coming down and the fireworks are going off, and Gary Michael Capetta says, and the new world heavyweight champion, Sid Vicious, and I'm just crying my eyes out. And all of a sudden, it's really, really fast, too. All of a sudden, Sting with a little
bit
of...
I think they were running over. They had to be running over at this point, because it all moves way, way, way too fast.
Sting with a teeny tiny, very thinly put together rope around his wrist comes back into the ring, and he decks Sid from behind. Our new champion gets decked from behind, and then Sting, we believe it's Sting now, just does the Stinger splash into the inside cradle, and then boom, 1, 2, 3, and then we hear the bell ring again, and then we have another new or still world champion, and that's Sting, and we're all like, what the hell just happened? And Jim Ross let the cat out of the bag that perhaps it was Barry Windham who was actually the fake Sting, and that the other Sting got jumped from behind while Rick and Arn are out there, and they tried to tie him up. Obviously, it didn't work because their rope was extraordinarily thin. It might as well just have tied him up with yarn. And because of the time constraint, we have our champion is still Sting, but it was very bizarre the way things just went down. It's like heel Sid wins the title, or so we thought, and they put out all the stops, all the special effects, all the bells and whistles for this title change, and then it was all for naught.
Now, JT, my question for you, how did this finish hurt the ultimate? No, I'm just kidding.
Quite badly, because, you know, this is a great now. I was sitting there wondering, I'm like, is this the match with the, is, I don't, I thought it was, because I didn't realize how late in the going
it happened. Yeah, it happens so late. There's
and
like
then
no
it's like
time
so
left.
Fast.
Doing the same thing.
They rush it right through. Cause I was thinking, I'm like, well, did they fight again? And I could swore it was here, you know, like, cause I remember what Sting had on, and, you know, Wyndham wearing the same thing. And, I just remember being really confused, because I did not expect it to happen so late in the match. And it does. But it was really confusing the way this restarted. Like, they don't even announce. The balloons are coming, like Dan was saying. But, and they don't even announce anything. They're just like, all right, this thing just attacks him and rolls him up. And it's just weird. I mean, it protects it a bit and puts over the horsemen. But I don't know. It made Sting's reign feel all just like super cartoony with the magic stuff earlier, this stuff here. It's like, I don't know. It's like he's in a cartoon world fighting all these weird villains. And as cartoony as Warrior looked and felt at times, like I thought at least he had a little bit more realistic feuds or matches anyway, versus what Sting was getting with all this nonsense.
Unbelievably enough, I think you're right. Ultimate Warrior was the far more down-to-earth champion at this point. Will, overall on the show, how much does this final match and the convoluted finish hurt the show? Is it still a solid show? Is it still a thumbs up?
Well, I'm going to say it with the caveat, if you're watching this version, yes, it's a thumbs up. But, man, there was a lot of filler we avoided, man. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We didn't get to see the Master Blasters. Okay, we didn't get to see Junkyard Dog defeat Moondog Rex.
Ooh.
We missed Terry Taylor and Wild Bill Irwin, and I think both guys are okay, but
yeah,
probably not in 1990. Brad Armstrong versus J.W. Storm, I don't even remember that match. And so I'm going to say if you consider the entire show, it's a thumbs in the middle, okay, because of the bad ending plus, like, all that filler. But for this version that we reviewed tonight, I'm going to say thumbs up because, I mean, everything besides the Freebirds tag and the main event, the rest of the matches were really fun and yep. entertaining, if not downright great, you know. So, yeah, the version we watched on the network, thumbs up. The real version, thumbs in the middle.
JT, where do you rank this show?
Yeah, I'd say the same. I mean, I had the version we watched had three, you know, really, really good to great matches in those tags. Mm-hmm. Hanson Luger was fun. Main event is okay considering who's in it. Like, I actually thought Sid did okay out there. The end feels rushed and tacked on and really kind of unnecessary. But I really liked Ross and Paulie on commentary, so that was good. I liked the feel of the show, the look of the show. Definitely made it stand out. I mean, at 2 hours, it's a real crisp watching. Like Will said, I don't know if you tack on those four matches. And it's not good that those four matches like in a row in the middle, too. So it probably really grounded the card down. But here, when you're going from Nasty Steiners right into Flair and Arn and Doom, that's a hell of a bridge that you're not having to worry about the crap in the middle. So I'm with Will. I say thumbs up for this version. And I'd never seen the version with the other way, but I would imagine it takes a slight dip.
Dan, I think you've earned the right to have the final word here. You did yeoman's work explaining the angles and also dealing with all of Ole Anderson's booking. So what did you think of this show, both as a kid and watching it again now?
Well, as a kid, I wore out this tape. So I wish I still had it because I still have a VCR because I'm kind of curious to see what it would be like. I mean, I'm sure I could look it up on YouTube, but it probably won't. As having like hey, tracking issues.
I might have a DVD copy of a VCR version, Dan. If I do, I'll make sure to get that your way.
Oh, I'd take it. I definitely would. Because it would take me back to a simpler and cooler time. But I'm a little bit jaded because, again, this is has such sentimental value. I can't say that I remember too much of those middle matches, but for me at the time, it didn't matter. It was watching wrestling. It was a surprise. I didn't realize we were going to order this, and you're letting me order it, and had a lot of fun watching it back then. So definitely thumbs up for me. It had everything that you wanted out of an early 90s show. You had like cheesy graphics. You had a lot of 90s cheese. You had Doom's theme song. You had some good in-ring action for the matches that we saw. You really kind of got like a nice taste of tag team wrestling if you're not accustomed to that nowadays because there aren't a lot of tag team matches on pay-per-view. This would be a show that you got a lot of different styles of brawls, the good wrestling matches, you know, the face and peril stuff in that first match. You know, the kind of very odd heel versus heel thing with the Doom and the Horseman stuff. Yeah, the ending was very convoluted and odd, but so was this time period. If you look at the Black Scorpion angle. But a pretty good show and part of a good series of 1990 world championship wrestling pay-per-views that were pretty good to great. So definitely check it out.
Well, gentlemen, this was a treat. It was not a trick by any means, although I guess I kind of tricked you guys into being here somehow. Listen to these guys every other week on the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. We will have another PTBN Rewind next month, of course. It's November, so I'm sure we'll do November to Remember. Just kidding, it's probably going to be Survivor Series. Thank you, Basil. And until next time, guys, be kind, rewind, and we will talk to you in November.